Well, good morning, students. This is Humanities 1, a freshman class covering Western civilization from the ancient Greeks and Roman time period up to modern Europe. We use church history as the backbone, though, as the God is primarily working through Jesus Christ to accomplish his purposes in this world. His kingdom is foremost, and as Ephesians says, that God has put Christ as head over all things for the church. And so it is our delight to know this plan. We are the only ones who have the bird's eye view of history because we've been told it by the one who's in the heavenlies. And so we have the delight to actually know where the big program is moving. And we can look behind us and see how many civilizations have quit, how many times things have gone to dead ends, and we know that the church continues to be built and the word continues to spread, even not despite the blood of the martyrs, but as Tertullian, a church father, said, even because of. And so we are thankful that our God knows how to accomplish his purposes through hard things. All the way from Genesis, where Joseph was sold into slavery, but it became the salvation for many, as he told his brothers, to the New Testament, to Jesus Christ, the Lamb of God, who is slain for the salvation of the world. The three time periods of church history that we're going to cover, and that's going to lead us from the past to the present, we have the ancient times, or the patristic era of church fathers, which is coming out of the classical era of the Greeks and the Romans in the Mediterranean world. That era ends with the coming of the barbarian tribes. Most of you are barbarians, if you didn't know that. Most of you who have Germanic roots and blood, at least those in my class in northern United States, in this part that was settled 200 years ago by European immigrants, you guys are largely barbaric. And it reminds me of a story told by Benjamin Disraeli. He was the Prime Minister of Great Britain, and he was Jewish. And he was put down by some in that Victorian England setting in late 1800s as having Jewish roots. And he made the comment that, basically, while my ancestors were translating the scriptures, your ancestors were eating each other. And so it reminds us of the past that just like we saw in the fall of the year with the Scythians, that very barbaric of the barbaric tribes in Herodotus' histories, the Scythians are part of the mission of Christ, according to Colossians chapter 3, and so were the Germanic tribes. Illiterate tribes, they had their own way of rule, and they were, in some regards, at least the Anglo-Saxons, very democratic in some respects under their king, and so having a representation in their government. Nonetheless, they were pagan, and when they flooded into Europe, the Goths, the Visigoths, the Vandals, the Angles, the Saxons, and several other varieties of tribes, when they flooded into Europe in the 400s, they established a new time period in Western Europe. I guess the Rhine River flooded over and allowed the barbarians just to flood into the Roman territories. Before that, the Roman legions were able to kind of keep them at bay as the tribes came from northern or from Central Asia into Northern Europe. By the way, your language also represents the roots in that time period. English from the Anglo-Saxon and German and Swedish and Dutch and all those Germanic languages have similarities to India. And so you can trace it all back. It becomes one big family, the Indo-European language family. And so it's all related to that Central Asia period. As if you look at the Indian people on the continent of India, they have facial features very similar to Europeans. And so Caucasian is a word that's used sometimes to describe all those people. That time period brought in the Dark Ages, a time period where illiteracy was present. The habits of education and culture of the Roman Empire ceased largely. And so as a result of that, it seemed to be a period where it was dominated by power and rule and a lot of little kingdoms and clans and feudal kind of set up in Europe under various lords developed. And so the Dark Ages then represents the end of the classical era, the end of classical learning. And so the Middle Ages is not, though, equated to the Dark Ages. The Middle Ages are not time periods of like ignorance and non-learning. You will discover this spring as you read Anselm and other writings that the Middle Ages are quite accomplished in learning. They perhaps are mistaken in taking the ancients too seriously, the Greeks and the Romans, on certain things, but they are not uneducated people. In fact, a lot of our modern institutions begin in the Middle Ages. Science begins, I believe, with what Roger Bacon, at least, and others, Albert the Great, incorporating Aristotelian thought and looking at nature. You also have hospitals, and other benevolent institutions, beginning some of that from the Crusades, which we'll talk about. You also have universities, a whole organized system of knowledge underneath theology is the queen. And then a large group endeavor to learn across Europe. You have a new Tower of Babel situation with Latin being the common language of Western Europe, which allows people from all these various nationalities to communicate fluently with each other as well as with the church and their government bodies. And so the Middle Ages is not the Dark Ages. That's just that transition period back in the 500s and 600s and all. But once the Middle Ages are up and going, especially in around the 11th century, there is a lot of learning that takes place. And a lot of what we have today is really built on that time period. The modern era comes about from changes in church and state. In church, you have the Protestant Reformation, which begins with Martin Luther and the questioning of the primacy of the Pope and of the Roman Catholic claim to be the church that's universal. Catholic means universal. The church at Rome claimed to be over all the other churches, like a first among equal. The Protestants, I believe rightly, questioned that and questioned it on the basis of the original documents of Christianity, which is the Bible, and through the giftedness of the Holy Spirit. And so that makes a break with the Middle Ages, where Rome was hardly questioned, except by a few. There's also a change in the state as modern states begin to assert themselves. Kings begin to assert divine right of kings, even some by the 1600s. And so a sense of nationalism is very strong, and the development of the modern state begins. And they lose their ties slowly, but begin to lose their ties with the church. It starts with questioning the church and the church's sole authority. By church, I mean the Catholic Church. And so there's changes then that occur within both the politics in the state, changes that occur within the religion of the day, within Catholicism. And so modern Europe develops after that. Even though some countries may remain Catholic, they're not very Catholic after a couple centuries. They begin to be culturally Catholic. The Roman Catholics begin to lose a lot of the say within those lands. And by the 19th century, I think it's Pope Pius IX is really complaining about modern times and trying to assert papal authority. Okay, so I hope you get the idea of the three time eras. You have the ancient era, the Greeks and the Romans, and the early church and the church fathers that come out of that, Athanasius, Augustine, you've read about them. Then you have the Middle Ages, which is going to have a predominantly by the time the 11th century occurs in the 1000s, a lot of new authors, new philosophers, new theologians, new institutions. Europe is rebirth, and then you have the modern era. The two dates I'm going to require you to remember. Number one, you need to remember the crowning of Charlemagne. We'll talk about that in an upcoming lesson. That's December 25th, Christmas Day, 800. It's an easy day to remember. Christmas, AD 800. The other date you're going to be required to remember is the start of the Protestant Reformation, October 31st, 1517. Let me introduce to you the topic today of Patrick of Ireland. The Irish are a special people. There's a lot of ironies with regard to the Irish. At this time period that I'm going to describe, they are not Roman Catholic. Rome has actually tried to evangelize them in AD 431 under a man named Palladium. It failed. And so Ireland will remain independent of Rome for a time period, and especially in its early time under Patrick. In fact, Patrick is even independent of Britain, of the church back home. He's Welsh and or British, original British, and he's renounced by that church. And so he's independent even of that church, let alone of Rome. Now, his forms of religion are Catholic in some regards, as far as how he might do church, and having creeds that are reflective of the Trinity. He publishes his own creed. You'll read about that in his confessions. It's included. It is not his composition. He didn't write it. But probably the church back home, he's adopted it or taken it wholesale or maybe tweaked it. But it is not part of the Nicene Creed or something you would find back in Rome. It's independent of that. So it's interesting that at this time period, the Irish are not Catholic. We will find under talking about Bede that the English are Catholic. So it's the English are Roman Catholic, and Ireland is free from Rome at this time period. The other thing that's interesting that makes the Irish unique is that while Rome herself retained knowledge and learning to some degree during this time period, and does evangelistic efforts of sorts, it's an imperial evangelism, imperialistic, like an empire, has a king over kings, the Pope wants to be a pastor over pastors, and thinks that everybody should be underneath Rome, even in the East, where the Greek church is. Ireland remains independent of Rome, but preserves knowledge and preserves scriptures. And the monks on Ireland, those that dedicate themselves to God and to learning and to a strict way of life, there's some dangers in that, as we've seen with Antony and others. These become so dedicated to Christ and to learning and to propagating the scriptures, and they all come from Patrick's mission, which I'll describe in a second, that they then go back to the continent of Europe and evangelize the Saxons, for example, and others. And there's some really neat stories. I think one guy chops down a sacred tree and proves that it's not, magical or devilish. I suppose the devil used it to scare people and such, but in the name of Christ, he defied it, cuts down the tree, and I forget if his name was Boniface. I think that's a pseudonym that's adapted by him. Which just means somebody who does good. So there's a lot of neat stories about these men that go back onto the continent and evangelize Europe. So here's the deal. There was a guy named Thomas Cahill. I don't recommend the book necessarily, but the title is neat. How the Irish Saved Civilization. The island of Ireland being like an island beyond an island. You have the island of Britain, which itself has been preserved from the continent through many different things by its isolation. Ireland is even beyond that. And so it was a kind of a secluded place that God evangelized in a miraculous way, we'll describe it in Patrick's life, and preserved learning there off by itself, very isolated. And so it's a really a great gift of God that the knowledge of the scriptures and other Christian learning was, and other learning was preserved there in those monasteries and then brought back to the continent later to evangelize the barbaric tribes. So let me talk a little bit about Patrick. A lot of what we know about Patrick comes down as legendary. You know, he used the shamrock to like describe the Trinity. And not only is that a heresy, as if God has parts, it's also historically inaccurate. I forget, I used to have a, before, you know, I've read on it when these things first appear in history, and it's 300 to 1,000 years after Patrick lived. And so chasing all the snakes off the island and, you know, having a mitre hat, which, you know, a big pointed hat, things like that. Those things, those all legendary stuff. And we have a lot of these kind of legends about the saints. It's called hagiography. So all you Greek students, hagios, Holy One, graphe, writing. So writings about the Holy One or writings about the saints is hagiography. And so you'll get stories about, you know, St. Nicholas, who, I don't know, slapped Arius at the Nicene Council. I don't think either of them were present. I'm doubtful about that, and especially doubtful about a slapping. And so, you know, they make for interesting stories, St. Valentine and other stories about the saints that then get told and passed on and encourage virtue and benevolence and good living and such. We actually have this in America. There's a fellow named Parson Weems that a generation after George Washington was selling books, telling stories about Washington, cutting down a cherry tree, and I can tell no lie. That kind of a thing. People love to hear it. If they're religiously devoted to a movement, they want to hear these stories about past heroes. And we find out a lot of these past stories are legends. They're made up. Now, some may say, well, what does it really matter? I mean, if it's a good story, it's a good story, and it encourages people. And I can understand inspiring people through a story, but when you pass it off as truth, and then people find out it's not true, there's a disillusionment that happens. It can do great damage. Now, there's something in our... America has their own philosophy, a homegrown American philosophy called pragmatism. We're going to talk about that later in coming years. But pragmatism is basically, if it works, it's true. If you want to stretch it out to eternity, everything that works is going to be true because it's going to correspond to reality. But in the meantime, there may be some things, a lie, that might make me feel better. Mr. Snyder, your tie looks really good. And you say, you know, and I look at you and say, oh, thank you. I was wondering about that. I'm colorblind, and you're kind of snickering to yourself because I mismatch colors, tie with my shirt or something like that. But I go off feeling better. I'm a more holistic person. I'm psychologically at ease now because you have told me my tie looks good. Well, when I find out that it didn't and I embarrass myself all day, I will not feel so good or psychologically whole or comforted. And so the truth is our friend, and Jesus said the truth sets us free. We need to know the truth about the past, about ourselves, about God and his ways. And so even though Linus might appear to be a psychologically adjusted and wholesome person because he believes in the Great Pumpkin, every October 31st, he is disappointed because it doesn't rise in the pumpkin patch. And so we do not believe in a Jesus who will not, who did not rise from the dead, or a Jesus who does not return. Our Lord will return because the Bible is true. And we are not believing these things because it makes us psychologically helped. And so we want truth. And I trust that's true in your heart and life. And I desire it in myself as well. Thankfully, we can know the truth about Patrick because we actually have Patrick's own hand telling us his story. He wrote a book. Actually, he wrote two things maybe more, but two at least have lasted down to us through the centuries. This is highly unusual for a so-called saint to actually have his own writings. Interestingly, when you actually read what Patrick wrote, he had an inferiority complex. If the hagiography presents the saints as superheroes, Patrick presents himself as a rusticimus, is his Latin word, a very rustic or country bumpkin person. And he also calls himself a peccator, I believe, a sinner. And so Patrick introduces himself not as some great superhero, saint kind of guy. He introduces himself as just this poor sinner who's very rustic, a country hick. And there's good reason why he's very self-conscious about his lack of education. His Latin is atrocious. There are places where the best of best scholars cannot even translate what he said, and they just have to give us guesses. So when you read what he's written, there are places that are just actually, seems to be what he wrote. We get the gist of it, but to get down to details, we have to be cautious because his Latin is almost untranslatable at places. And so this is due to the fact that he was kidnapped. He was kidnapped when he was 16 and probably hadn't completed his education. He grew up in church, and his dad, I believe, was a deacon, and I think maybe his grandpa was an elder or a priest. At any rate, he's kidnapped by pirates. He lived on the western coast of Britain, which is where the Welsh are today, and he is an ancestor of the Welsh. An original British young man, and he got kidnapped, brought across the Irish Sea by the Irish, who are utter pagans. You know, the Druids and all that stuff. There's no light of Christianity on that island. He didn't even know their language. He's brought to the far end of the island. He has to care for sheep. And there, he says, he finally knew God. For you who are students in high school, this is such an important lesson. You can grow up in church, you can know all the answers, but usually, often, let's say, a crisis is what brings Christ home to your heart, where you finally begin to own the faith for yourself and seek God for yourself. Like we've learned in theology too, the pursuit of God. Often that becomes a reality when a crisis comes. And you will thank God for it later in life. I think Patrick would have, obviously, he rejoiced in knowing God. He says that his times out in the pasture became times of just calling on God and knowing God. And so I pray that'll be true in your life as well. He even tells us that he would pray 100 times a day. You can only talk to the sheep so long, I suppose, and nobody else is out there. At some point, God calls him. Now, there's claims. Patrick makes claims of having visions and conversations with God. I personally do not doubt this to be the fact. The rest of the book breathes such an air of humility, a kind of humility. I'll talk about that at the end. Such an air of self-deprecation. I don't think he's boasting in that way, though he's using it to justify himself. And so, anyways, he's called back home, and it's an interesting journey. I won't spoil that one. It's quite precarious because the people that want to bring him back home want to kill him at a certain point, and then they kind of pressure him and prove himself. Eventually he gets home, and it looks like end of story. But God calls him like God called Paul in Acts 16 with the Macedonian call. God calls Patrick back to Ireland. Come back and help us, holy boy. And so he senses this is a divine calling. He has some training in the church. He's commissioned by his own church back in Britain and goes to evangelize the Irish. It's not easy. I mean, not only there does he have death threats, I believe he has a bodyguard, he gets imprisoned some. He has to be very cautious how he handles money so he doesn't get framed and lied about and slandered. The letter that you're going to read to Caratacus is a pirate who claimed to be a Christian and is like kidnapping and raping women. And he like chews him out. It says, you have no right to assume you're going to heaven. I'm going to have you read that letter as part of your homework too. But that wasn't half of the problem. The other half of the problem was his church back home disowned him because somebody revealed something he had done before he was even kidnapped, before he even knew Christ. Somebody claimed and revealed what he had done, say, when he was 15. This is kind of the thing we see happening in the news these days. Politician who may be in his 50s or 60s being slandered or talked about by something he did as a teenager. This reminds us, and you are teens, that what you do now is not just an isolated thing. It does affect other people. And so be cautious on your choices. Be loving on your choices. Be wise. This hurt Patrick greatly. It hurt him that a friend betrayed him and betrayed a trust and confidentiality. It hurt him that his church disowned him. But in the spirit, he was constrained not to go back to Britain. He's constrained. He can't do it. And so as a result of this, Patrick is left on the island. And he writes then this defense. I think this writing, this confession, is a personal vindication of sorts. That the people who have disowned him back in Britain don't know what they're talking about. And if you look at the phenomenal numbers, the thousands that have come to Christ, and the way the whole island is Christianized, and so many Irish become true Christians, it is undoubted in my mind that God used Patrick. Jesus used Patrick to evangelize the Irish. When you read his confessions, you will see he is a man, as one scholar said, a man of one book, Unilibri. He is a man of the Bible. He quotes it all the time. Sometimes I think his interpretations are spot on. Sometimes I think they're questionable. Sometimes I think they're pretty creative or interesting. But boy, he quotes it all the time. And if he didn't have an education, he definitely has a Bible. And he loves the Bible. And so in this regard, he is evangelical. In his approach to Christianity, he bases his faith on the Bible and he looks to convert people. And so I really appreciate Patrick. He's one of the reasons why we celebrate St. Patrick's Day as a school. We're not doing it obviously this year, but as we celebrate it, we are celebrating a true missionary and we're celebrating true missions, evangelizing truly pagan, unreached peoples with the light of Jesus Christ. The only truth that will set them free for eternity, not just make them psychologically calm for a season. Jesus Christ really saves. And so the funny thing about it is Patrick quotes several places, I believe, the Great Commission about going to the ends of the earth. He doesn't know about North America or South America. He doesn't know there's anything beyond the Great Western Sea, which we call the Atlantic Ocean. He thinks he's at the edge of the world, the edge of the land. The ends of the earth means the edge of the land. He thinks he's there. He thinks he's completing the Great Commission. He thinks Jesus now can come back. This also shows his Christ-loving spirit, how he loves the appearance of Jesus Christ and is looking for that. May we too love that. And love that mission. But it's interesting that he didn't know. And so God didn't open his eyes to actually know. I think if he had known, I think he still would have evangelized the island. But it became part of his motivation. So that's kind of interesting in light of what I said earlier. If you don't know the truth, but it's helping you, what's the big deal? And so, who knows what Patrick in heaven is thinking? But obviously, we know now that there was still much work to be done and there remains much work. And so in Humanities 2, we'll learn about William Carey's reviving of the Great Commission among Western Europeans, because so many were saying that the Great Commission applied only to the apostles. Well, it's interesting. Patrick definitely wouldn't have believed that. And so I hope this is helpful. Please read then. Your assignment is going to be to read Patrick's Confessions and the letter to Caroticus, and also then to write me an essay on three characteristics of Patrick's person, who he is as a person. So character, he's courageous, or he's loyal, or believing, or devout, or something that just stands out to you as you're reading. Make sure that your essay has quotes in it, that you can document what you're saying with proof. And so give me that essay by email for next week. And so Lord bless you in your reading, and may God be praised for what he did through Patrick.